Good evening, everyone. Happy Shabbat. Yada here. We've got Larry and JB as well. How are you guys?
Doing good.
Just phenomenal.
Well, it's great. Just ran into an interesting situation. I was translating Daniel 7, Daniel, God Judges and Vindicates 7, which is, you know, speaks of the great sweep of history from the rise and fall of the Babylonian Empire, the Persian Empire, the Greek Empire, Macedonian Empire of Alexander the Great, and then ultimately the ugliest, nastiest, and most vicious of the empires. God's not very impressed with ancient Rome. And then how out of all of that there would be, you know, there's 10 horns in the beast that represents ancient Rome. And so it was kind of interesting to figure out, you know, what are the divisions in ancient Rome? Well, I didn't even know that ancient Rome was divided into 10 divisions, and it turns out that the Western Empire had 10 divisions, and then those 10 divisions of the Western Empire coalesced into 5. And then there were 5 divisions in the Eastern Roman Empire. So, in fact, there were 10 horns, if you will, 10 provinces in ancient Rome, just as it was predicted. And then it says that that there's going to be a new horn, small, lowly and little, it even says. Lowly and little might ring a bell to us in the...
Apollos?
You got it.
Yes.
Yeah, it actually calls this new horn lowly and little. I almost swallowed my tongue laughing when I read that. But it does call it lowly and little, and then, you know, and it says that it's, you know, a new horn. So, and it comes in between the existing horn. So you've got a situation where this horn has to not only emerge from one of the 10 Roman provinces, but it has to be, you know, in the midst of them. It can't be like Britain was one of them. That's a pretty far extreme. And, you know, Egypt was one. That's another far extreme. It's got to be something that's in between the mess of them. And then it says that it has to be new. And so, and I went through every one of them, and it's really interesting. You can you end up coming down to one. There's only one of the kingdoms where within that region there is a new country. Only one. And so all you have to do is use recent history. 1991 is when that particular country was founded, and the next earliest, you have to go back to World War One. In fact, before World War One, the next youngest country is over 100 years old. And so you end up with one country that it can be, and then it says that you know, 3 of the horns are going to lose their authority as a result of this one. And then you look at, well, what countries that were divisions of Rome are going to be willing to join an alliance with this guy? And there's only 3. And so it, all of a sudden, what looked complicated becomes extraordinarily clear as to where this this bad boy is going to come from. And there's no reason to go over the whole thing right now, the answer is Macedonia. Absolutely, unequivocally, he is going to be a leader of Macedonia. And the 3, which was one of the 10 Roman provinces, but it is a brand new country formed in 1991. It uses an old name, but it has no connection to that name nor to the original Macedonia at all. And the 3 countries that are going to ally with it, there's only 3 countries that were part of the old Roman Empire. There has to be 10 of the original that ally with it, are the 3 southern European countries that are all either very close to being on the outs with the EU or want to be part of the EU but don't qualify, and they are Italy, Greece, and Turkey. And this fellow, which is a in a country with a fairly equal blend between socialist, secularists, communists, if you will, Orthodox Christians, and Muslims, is going to be the perfect place to build that alliance between the three economically ravaged, if you will, countries out of the old Roman Empire. It's going to be he's going to come from Macedonia, and he's going to form an alliance with Italy, Greece, and Turkey. Clear as the nose on our faces. It's pretty obvious. One of the other things that's really interesting as I was going through this today, Daniel got to see God on his throne. And, you know, he talks about what God looked like and the like. And he made a comment that there was an aspect of God's throne that was a Gaal. Now, have either of you guys ever heard it? Now, this is written in Aramaic, mind you. But there is a Hebrew word, Gaal. My first time ever trying to translate Aramaic also, which is kind of funny in a way. But if you guys, I don't hear anybody jumping up, but Gaal. Does that name ring a bell to you? All right. Gaal.
I'm trying to remember. I'm drawing a blank on it, but I recognize
right.
the word.
All right. You know, that's the fun of doing this, by the way, is that as I love... You know, if you can find something that just strikes you and said, okay, why did we hear this? Because he's... If you look at English translations, it would say that that Gaal is a wheel. All right? A wheel is something that rolls, by the way, right? Well, Gaal is the same exact word, is a wheel that is ablaze with radiant energy, just pure white light. And I remember that Gaal was an extremely important term. In fact, somebody listening to our program wrote me a letter and said, you know, if Jesus wasn't bodily resurrected, why did they have to roll away that stone? And my answer was, Gaal. That's why the stone had to be rolled away. I mean, it was important for the disciples to be able to get inside and see that, you know, there was nothing but an empty shroud, and he wasn't there. But beyond that, you had to fulfill the promise of Gaal. And where Gaal comes from, and it's so just consistent for Yahweh to do things this way, as the children of Israel were in the last day of their walk through the wilderness, and they are finally at the Jordan River, and this is the day they get to enter the promised land and cross the Jordan. Yahweh makes it a point to say, Gaal, on this day as you cross the Jordan, I'm going to roll away your iniquity. And so the stone that was rolled away in front of Yosha's ever so briefly borrowed tomb was
pretty
Gaal.
Strong and symbolic.
Oh, yeah. The stone that was rolled away was Gaal. That was how he rolled away the iniquity. He's talking about you enter the promised land. I'm rolling away your iniquity, Gaal. And now, as part of his throne, as he's sitting there, he's got Gaal. A brilliant white light means to obliterate everything that's a flaw as part of our nature so that we can approach him. And literally rivers of light flow out of these Gaal. Means to roll away our iniquity. It's just... You know, little things, but the little things with Yah are fun to track down because the connections are so interesting. Little details woven through the whole story, and I'm sure he put those things in there, hoping that we would make the connection. You know, make the connection between the children of Israel, Gaal, having their iniquity rolled away before they entered the promised land, and the place where they're crossing the Jordan River, it's Jerusalem, where and Mount Moriah are towering right above them. You know, it's for those who have been to Israel, Jerusalem sits up in amongst the hills, amongst Mount Moriah. Mount Zion, the Mount of Olives. And once you leave Jerusalem, I mean, you're 2 minutes out of Jerusalem, you're heading straight downhill, and you're going straight to the Jordan River Valley. And so they would have looked up, and they would have looked at the very place that Gaal was going to happen. Yes, and in fact, Pinks in the chat room says Ezekiel saw the wheel too. In fact, Ezekiel, Yakis-El, depiction of Yahweh and of the of his throne and the Gaal is identical. But anyway, I was trying to figure out, well, come on, they can't have wheels on God's throne. I mean, it's not like he's an old guy that, you know, I mean, he is an old guy, but, you know, it's not like, you know, you need to roll him around in a wheelchair. There's not wheels sitting on the side of his throne. So what in the world is this? And, I'm struggling here because everything I'm doing now is in Aramaic, and there's, you know, with Hebrew, I've got 25 lexicons. With Aramaic, I've got 3. And so it's a big, much bigger challenge. But in this case, I was able to track it down. And I'm rambling now, but I thought it was fun and interesting to make the connection. All right, we were at the 46th verse of Psalm 119 when we ended our program a week ago, and I'd just like to pick up where we were at, and if y'all want to lead this in a different direction and talk about something else, feel free to do so. This statement says, I will choose to continually speak the word, Dabar, within your witness. So it's not just any word. The words that I'm going to speak are the words within Yahweh's witness. They would be comprised of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. In fact, if you wanted to use one word for the whole thing, it would be Torah, because it would be Yahweh's teaching and instruction, and his teaching and instruction permeates the Psalms and permeates the prophets. So I will choose to continually speak the word within your witness, reporting it before and against the leaders of mankind's political, religious, economic, and military institutions, his Malek. And I will not hesitate to be emotionally distressed. Actually, it says, I will not hesitate nor be emotionally distressed. So I should have said that a little up. I think I miscited that. But I will not hesitate nor be emotionally distressed. There's two aspects of this that are three, actually, that I think are worth reinforcing. The first is, there is no more, if you want to be smart, and Dode was the smartest dude who ever lived. He was the real Einstein, the real Isaac Newton, actually the smartest individual who ever lived is Dode. And if you want to be really smart, the single most important thing you can do is to study and speak Yahweh's testimony. In fact, if you want to come across as brilliant, got a great way to do it. Speak Yahweh's testimony. In a letter I received from Adam Miller, who is the syndicator for GCN, and he was talking about the Shattering Myths show, he says, you know, quite honestly, you are the most interesting man I have ever heard, most interesting man I know. And I, my first response to that is, yeah, right. Come on. And then I said, no, it's true. It's because you want to sound smart. You want to be interesting. Talk about what Yahweh has said. If you speak about the words within Yahweh's witness, you will be interesting and you will come across as smart. That's what Dode did. You know, Larry, you constantly are entertaining the religiously challenged. And there is one way to always be right, always be pertinent, always be interesting, always be wise, always be correct.
Yeah, share Yahweh's words and leave yourself out of it.
There you go. That's absolutely true.
Believe me, I've had people tell me you're brilliant.
Yes.
You know, it's almost laughable. I mean, really. But
of course. Of course. But when we share Yahweh's words, we are being brilliant. That is the smartest thing you can possibly do.
There you go.
So, I mean, you want to be brilliant. You want to be smart. You want to be right. You know, a lot of people have a tendency to want to be right all the time. There's a real easy way to be right all of the time. It's a real easy way to be trustworthy, to be interesting, to be pertinent, to be valid. Do what Doe did here. I mean, Doe's got some really practical advice. And all we have to do is take his advice and apply it to ourselves in first person. And I will choose to continuously speak the word within your witness, reporting it before and against the leaders of mankind's political, religious, economic, and military institutions. And I will not hesitate or be emotionally distressed. All right, so the second part of that is that Dode is recommending that we do something that I've always been a little leery of doing, which is approaching the political and approaching the religious. You know, I've got no issue if the religious or political approach me and then giving them both barrels. But in this particular case, that's what Dode is saying. Go after them. But I don't think Dode is saying go after them in the sense of going down to City Hall or going into the local synagogue. I don't think that's what he's saying. I just think that Dode is saying, I'm going to write this stuff down. I'm going to proclaim this. I'm going to sing it. And what I'm saying is I'm wielding Yahweh's words against human institutions and human leaders. And in that case, it's what we do, what you do on your website, Larry. It's what I do in the Shattering Myths show. It's what the books are all about, is we are wielding Yahweh's words against human religious and political schemes.
Yeah, and I just want to mention, it's what a lot of people in the chat room today that are on FB do. I mean, we do it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's we get out there and just throw it out there. I mean, that's the way it is. I'd called in today and talked to you about somebody who was all over you using the word, the English noun God, as though
right.
it were a name, as though you don't share Yahweh's names all the time. You know, but I left out the fact the same individual wants to, you know, he wants to use religious copy edits like calling Torah law, you know, which I find reprehensible at this point. I don't like people doing it. I correct them. I show them. And about the third or fourth time, I think that I'm talking to a brick wall, an idiot who is immersed in religion, and I walk away.
And you and I have talked about why we don't have any issue using the noun God, because it's not a name. The encouragement from Yahweh is not to speak on behalf of and to memorialize false gods. By using the noun God in reference to Yahweh, capital G, and lowercase g in reference to false ones, I'm not only following Yahweh's example, but I'm not saying the name of a false god. And God didn't say that we couldn't use the name of false gods. He does regularly. I mean, how many times does he use Baal, Lord?
Baal.
Yeah, and he's got lots of them. I mean, we were on a particular passage where we're talking about the Asherah. And so God uses the names of false gods all the time. But He doesn't
memorialize them and make them out to be great.
He's exposing and condemning them. He's belittling them. And it's appropriate for us to use terms like that to belittle them. Now, as the complaint would go, at least the notion of you're not always using Yahweh's name, Yahweh doesn't always use his name. Now, he uses his name 7,000 times, and I use his name a lot, too. But he uses the title almost as often as he uses the name. You know, he'll say, Yahweh, you know, I am the God of Yisrael.
So, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob.
Right. And if we just repeat the Hebrew term, we're not accomplishing anything because it's not a name. You know, the rules on translation, if you're going to be accurate, you're going to be consistent in translation, the rules are really simple. You transliterate names, which means you replicate the sound of the name using the letters of the translated alphabet. And so in English, it's Yahweh. That's a name. You always transliterate or replicate the pronunciation of names. And with words, you always translate them, which means you convey the same meaning using the words of the other language. The best translation of the way Yahweh uses El, Eloah, and Eloi, and Elohim related to himself would be as God, capital G. That's just the bottom line here. And so, no, I don't see a problem using it. I've received more hate mail based on using it than anything else. And I always write people back and say, you know, if the answer is to simply transliterate the word Elohim, why do we stop there? Why don't we transliterate Shamar and Shama and Haya and Kum and Mikra and Kara?
In other words, let's just speak Paleo Hebrew. You know,
there you go.
And the thing I would throw out here, and this is the
I can wave a wand and make that happen.
Yeah. By the way, I would love if every one of our conversations were in Hebrew. I would love it
and that
if
people could understand us.
And I wish I could think in Hebrew. I wish I would accept that in a second. But I'm not yet. Although I'm developing a capacity to. The more you do something, the better you get at it. I'm developing a capacity to think in Hebrew, and I like communicating in Hebrew. I mean, I love sharing the Hebrew terms, I've embraced them. I've accepted them. I love them.
Well, ultimately, that's what we're
them.
Doing here.
But yeah. But the best I have found that I can do and to communicate with people today is to share the Hebrew term and then to explain what it means in a language that we speak, which is English. So that's the technique. And, you know, if I lived in Spain or Mexico, I might be using Spanish to try to explain these words.
Yeah, I just want to say this, though, and I really need to say it. If a person is so hung up on this English noun, and Yahweh speaks of false gods, as we've talked mm-hmm. about, false Elohim.
Right.
Well,
yeah.
Let's get into, you know, calling the Torah the law and calling Shamar obedient.
Right.
And on and on. So why don't you just go ahead and call him Lord, since you changed his nature? By calling Yahweh is God, that is not
haven't changed
his
nature.
Nature.
No.
But calling Torah law and
changes
saying Abraham obeyed Yahweh like Fido the dog, you know, you've changed his nature, and you may as well just call him Lord at that point.
Yeah, actually,
so I'm becoming
what Yahweh says about Abraham is that he listened to him, he carefully considered what he had to say, he accepted what he had to say, he acted upon what he had to say, he trusted and relied upon what he had to say, but it was really the thing that
well, it's not like Yahweh came out there and laid commands out and he obeyed.
No, as a matter of fact, it's really interesting. The point that Yahweh says, you know, and I attributed this as vindication, as righteousness up to Abraham. It's really interesting what the trigger was for Yahweh saying, all right, dude, from this point on, my view of you is that you are righteous, that you are vindicated, that you're innocent. And it actually took place at a very transformative moment where Abraham wasn't doing anything. You see, and this is the killer, I think, for the concept of obey. Abraham went after God. And he says, God, you know, you keep on talking about inheritance. You keep on telling me what I'm going to inherit and that this covenant thing of yours is, I mean, I'm sure that his tone wasn't as rough as mine is right now, but it wasn't much different than this. He says, you keep on talking about inheritance. You keep on talking about all this that I'm going to inherit through this covenant. And God, I don't have a kid. I don't have a kid. How is it possible? I just don't get it. What is it that you're actually offering me? Because I don't understand. That's what Abraham said. And so what did God do?
He showed him.
He showed him. What did he do? He took Abraham to the spiritual realm. And then he showed him the light that emanates from stars. And he says, this is what I'm offering you. I'm going to turn you into light energy. You're going to be exactly like me. Look around heaven. That's what you see here. Let me explain
Abraham said he wasn't sure if he was on earth or if in heaven or how it happened or what. Or wait, that was Paul.
That was Paul. No, Yah was telling the story. Abraham's not telling the story. But Yah says, I took him there.
I'm kidding.
Yeah, I know. I took him to heaven. I showed him what the spiritual realm was like. I equated his future inheritance to light. I mean, that's
right.
The answer, folks. Your future inheritance is being transformed into light. Now, that's really cool because light is perfect. Light is eternal. Light is powerful. It's E equals MC squared. It's if you take whatever mass you have in your physical world situation and you multiply it by the speed of light times the speed of light, that gets you to an equation that tells you how much you're going to be magnified and empowered and enlightened to become light, and you become perfect and eternal. Light explains all of the benefits of the covenant, even explains adoption, which is one of the benefits of the covenant, because Yah is light. For us to be his sons and daughters, we have to be light. He, by showing him light, he explained it all. And then Abraham said, I get it. Now I understand. And the moment he said, I understand, those were the magic words. And I'm not using magic in the negative sense.
Right.
Those were the words that Yahweh wanted to hear, because the moment Abraham said, I get it now, I understand, I know what you're offering me, I understand what you're offering me, that instant, without doing anything, Yahweh said, I'm going to equate this to you being perfect. Now there's something to think about. That what God was really interested in is his attitude, his understanding.
He was understanding, and that's the point here.
Now, at that point, was Abraham's understanding perfect?
No.
No, because he continued to stub his toe all over the place. He even laughed at God. Right? So
that's right.
Abraham's understanding was still hugely imperfect at this point, as is ours. I mean, I'm going to tell you that even though Abraham had the opportunity to meet directly with Yahweh, I think our understanding of who Yahweh is and what he is offering is probably greater than it was at any time in Abraham's earthly life. And that's one of the other things that has struck me so profoundly over these last 5 or 6 years. You know how many people say, if God really wants me to know him, he's going to introduce himself to us. I'm not going to believe God unless he was standing right in front of me, that kind of thing. And my response to everyone is, you want to meet God? Read his Torah. You want him to be present right before you? Study his words. He's real. He's right there. He proves his existence. He is engaged in your life. You want to have him participate in your life? Observe his testimony. And he will, man. He's right there.
And what he's doing there, by the way, this is no small task. It's brilliant. To carry your words across thousands of years is an amazing feat.
Oh, of course.
It's amazing.
Well, here, look at this. We began this program with Gaal. Now, my guess is that I'm not the only one that was thrilled by that. To recognize that something Yahweh said over 3,000 years ago would equate to something that he did himself 2,000 years ago that was instrumental in our salvation, in our perfection, the very thing he was offering us, transforming us into light by rolling away all of our iniquity. And then the very throne that he sits on is equipped with this mechanism. And then you see, you equate that to the covenant, you equate that to what he did with Abraham, and it's God saying, yeah, that's why I put it there. I wanted you to figure it out. I wanted you to see it. I wanted you to enjoy it. I wanted to reinforce this knowledge and understanding.
Yeah, and these reinforcements matter.
They do.
It's like in Shavuot where he says, and they don't even question him when
right.
Paul's name means question him.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, these things are thrown out there, you know, on a pretty more consistent basis than we know.
Right, or if you're you're motivated to write a book trying to determine whether or not Paul was speaking for God or speaking against God, and you've devoted the better part of 10 years to trying to understand what God is trying to convey, and you come up with the idea that, you know, I think what I ought to call this thing is questioning Paul. And then somebody sends you 3 years later a passage that says, you may want to check this out. And it not only says that Shaul is the plague of death, which is the conclusion that you came to, but it says, you know, y'all may want to question him.
that makes you feel pretty solid about writing questioning Paul.
Whoa,
yeah,
does
exactly.
it ever? You know, it does.
And by the way, that's another thing that points to Paul. There's so many things in there that do. You know, this mm-hmm. one guy is going to mislead many different people from many different nations. He's going to speak
right.
out against uh-huh. circumcision.
Right.
But he's never questioned. And, you know, boy, the last thing you'd want to do is, well, I wouldn't mind doing it, but, you know, in these churches, they don't question him. Not
right.
a bit. I mean, they quote him, they parrot him, but they never question him.
Never question. I have a fellow, he's got an Indian-sounding name, he's written me 4 or 5 letters here recently that says, you know, how do you know, you go so far as you say that Paul is demon-possessed, you know, where do you get off on calling him demon-possessed? He says, I don't know if he's
in Scripture. He says he is.
You know, and I think, yeah, because he says he is, I says, don't blame me for calling Paul demon-possessed. He says he's demon-possessed. And then, you know, he's saying that, but, you know, how do you get around the fact that Peter endorsed his letters, in quotes, you know, Second Peter.
Peter endorsed his letters.
Yeah, yeah. And I said, would you ever
don't read them.
Reading?
They lead to death.
Right.
Well, that's a strong endorsement.
Did you ever consider, and he quoted, of course, the two passages that Christians quote. So did you ever consider reading that in context? Read it. Read what. Now, his name is actually Shimon, means he listens. But read what he said in context. And if you don't get it by reading it in context, then I present the whole thing laid out for you in context right after Paul condemns Shimon, condemns him. I turn to that passage and say, under this circumstance, is there any chance that Shimon would have endorsed Paul's letters? And I said, let's look at the one line that is used to justify them and determine whether or not it is a justification. Can't get the guy to read the book. You know, he just he says, you know, you have to prove this to me. Says, so you want me to rewrite the book just for you? Now, if I rewrite the book for you, it's probably not a very good use of my time because I've already spent 2 years doing it. But second of all, it's going to deprive you of the whole experience of seeing the whole case laid out systematically. Wouldn't that be a far more enjoyable experience to see the case laid down one line at a time?
Well, anyway, if I said, do not read Yada's books, they lead to disillusionment and Torahlessness. And somebody said to me, so you are endorsing Yada's books. I would assume that they were illiterate.
Yeah. That's why Calvin, who is, of course, extraordinarily Pauline, because with Paul you can get predestination and salvation through grace, and you get Christianity. So Calvin, who is the intellectual leader of Protestantism, if you will.
Yeah, Presbyterianism.
Yeah, particularly Presbyterian Protestantism. Calvin wanted to take 2 Peter out of the canon because he recognized that if you read 2 Peter in context, it says that Paul is a terrible writer, that his letters are confusing and deadly, and that they lead to away from God. And he says, so Calvin wanted 2 Peter removed, recognizing that in context, that statement is completely destructive.
Yeah, because of the verse that Christians try to use to say that Shimon supported Paulos. But let me say this.
But not if you read it in context. It sure doesn't.
He starts out by saying he speaks with human understanding. And right. And Sheol claims that he was speaking, with the full authority of the Ruach. Said he couldn't even lie.
Right.
I mean, these are some amazing things. I mean, right there, that puts an end to it. I mean, right away, he speaks with the human understanding given him. I mean, that's...
And this person says, why don't you cite the verse where God criticizes Paul? Well, how about the chapters? it's not a verse. It's two entire chapters systematically destroying the credibility and the viability of Paul's letters. Anyway.
So he wanted you to lay out one verse, huh? And you had 2 chapters for him.
Yeah.
Did it matter? The answer is no.
No, it didn't. Not, so far, it hasn't mattered. Now, he reminds me of so many people that say, can you just summarize that for me? Or if God's Spirit told me what I need to know about him, so, I don't need to read that stuff. I don't need to read that Old Testament because the Spirit's already told me what I need to know. People want it easy. They just want it handed to them. They, what is the magic formula for me to be saved? And let's forget about all the rest of that stuff. And
my wife's sister wanted her to sum everything she's learned up in 5 sentences.
Yeah. And you can't do that with Yahweh.
No.
He is wholly opposed to it. When somebody says, well, let's just say that God is love and that's really all you need to know.
That's
God is love, but he's a lot more than just love, and that's not all you need to know. If you don't enjoy what we're doing now, if you don't get turned on by finding connections and learning and making the transition from knowing to understanding, then you would be a real killjoy in heaven. And you're not welcome there. Heaven is for those who like what we're doing, who enjoy reading why Dode chose to constantly speak the word within Yahweh's witness. Now, when Dode was saying that, did the New Testament exist?
No, Marcion hadn't put that book out yet.
Yeah, hadn't put that book out yet. Yeah, so he wielded the same thing that we're doing, the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms against human institutions. Sounds like if he had the opportunity to have a show called Shattering Myths, he'd been really good at it. Now, one last thing on that passage. Dode says that he will not hesitate nor be emotionally distressed, never going to be ashamed, frustrated, or delayed. He didn't say, however, that he wasn't going to be angry. Did he?
No.
No, he didn't say that he wasn't going to be condemning. He didn't say going to be harsh. He didn't say he wasn't going to be hateful. What he said was, I'm not going to hesitate, and I'm not going to be emotionally distressed. And so there's a huge
difference. I know I'm not when I tell them what I think. You know, yeah. I mean, I compare what they say to Yahweh's words, and when they don't match up,
right.
I'm not distraught about it at all. They might want to get distraught about it.
Right. Yeah, you, what you'll do is typically you'll give the person the opportunity to say, all right, here's what you said. Here's what Yahweh says. They are extraordinarily different. And because they are so different, now, do you want to have the I'm going to give you the opportunity to align your perspective to his. Now, if you want to do that, if you're going to say, I was wrong, God is right, I'm now willing to accept God's position on this, great. Then we'll go on to the next point. If you want to hold to the position that you're right and that Yahweh is wrong, then we got nothing else to talk about.
You know, there's no point after that. And
that
I might give them 10 times. I'm so stupid, I might give them 10 times. All right? But, you know, at some point, I can see all they're doing is defending religion. They're defending a concept that isn't true. And really, the least compassionate thing we can do is pretend that something that is untrue can be compromised with. Because the fact is, it can't.
Yeah, you know, I was reading yesterday as I started, because I was sitting here, I was saying, okay, I've now finished the book that I really wanted to finish. I really badly wanted to retranslate Yeshayah 17 and 18, now that I could do a better job of Hebrew than I did before, now that I was complete, because I wrote it back in the time that I was still clingy to Christianity. And so I really wanted to do that. Now that was done, I was sitting here, all right, now I've got an opportunity. I've got a clean slate. Where do you want to go? And just decided that, you know, the thing I want to do is I want to do Daniel 7, 8, and 9. And so I said, all right, let's start there. So the first thing I wanted to do is say, okay, how much do we have of this in the Dead Sea Scrolls? And I was pretty much aware that we've got 8 from the Qumran community, another 4 outside the Qumran community. I think we have 12 extant copies of Daniel. And I knew this was the one book that was written in both Hebrew and Aramaic. It's about 80%, maybe 85 to 90% Hebrew and 10 to 15% Aramaic. And so I turned to my Dead Sea Scroll Bibles. I always like to start there and just get a feel for, you know, what do I have to work with here? Because I've come to be a little bit concerned about the Masoretic. And so I'm really a lot more comfortable when I've got a lot of Qumran scroll to work with. And even the authors, and the authors of the Qumran, the Dead Sea Scroll Bible, they don't know Yahweh from a horse's patootie. I mean, they're clueless. But even they said, you know, this is a remarkable man. And the reason this man that wrote this book is so remarkable is he was living in an extraordinarily pagan place, and yet he never once compromised. He was constantly harassed, and never once did he compromise. And that's what makes his book and his writing so special.
Yeah, when
and
you get thrown in the
den. Yeah, isn't that pretty amazing that even guys who I mean, I'm sure these guys don't even think that the book was inspired, but they realized that the thing that made this guy special is that he was living in the place that means corruption. That's what Babel means, is corruption. He was living in the place corruption. He was constantly being harassed to accept the Babylonian authority, the Babylonian gods, the Babylonian way, and he never once compromised. So if you want to be a mechanism for revealing Yahweh's witness, maybe that's a pretty good example to follow.
Well, I agree. I mean, we can't compromise. Not an inch.
Not
I mean,
an
if
inch.
We know better, we know better.
That's correct. Do not compromise. God is not into compromise. That's why the religion of Christianity, which is nothing but compromise, it's an amalgamation of virtually every religion that preceded it, that's exactly what God does not want us to do. All right,
well,
the next line.
That, That is really the definition of politics. It's the art of compromising. That's what politics is all about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to a large
degree. It is. It is the art of compromise. I'm going to read this next line. I understand that we have Diane with us, and so as soon as we read the next line, Diane, love to hear your question or comment. And I have elected to constantly delight in, and I have found great pleasure in the terms and conditions of your binding contract, which relationally I really love and desire. Well, you know, the interesting thing about the terms and conditions of a contract, typically each side is bound to have to perform in a certain way, and then the benefits are divvied up in a certain way. That's how you write a contract. You know,
that's what a contract is.
Agreeing to do certain things, and then they're going to get the share the benefits. All five benefits of the covenant are for us. Yahweh does get a benefit. He does delineate his benefit, but all five benefits that he specifies in a direct association with the covenant are for us. We become immortal, we become perfect, we become adopted, we are enriched, we are empowered. In essence, we become like light. There are five conditions of the covenant. He's talking about the conditions of the covenant, the five things that we must do, that we must embrace, that we must accept, that we must acknowledge to benefit from the covenant, to be part of the covenant. And here is Dode saying, man, those things are such a burden. Oh, my God, all day long I've got to agonize, I've got to obey all this garbage. I just hate this stuff. I mean, God, what am I doing, working for my salvation? I mean, give me a break here. Oh, no, that's not what he said. He said he loves the terms and conditions of the covenant. And so do I. And what are they? First, they're walk away from, disassociate yourself from confusion, from human institutions, from Babel, from Babylon, from religion, from politics, from militarism. And, Larry, you and I are poster childs for this. I mean, you probably even more than I on the political side. I more than you on the religious side. I mean, we were religious. We were political.
We were stupid.
Yeah. And you know something? Even though you were, a bigwig in the Florida Republican Party, and God, man, I must have known every bigwig in the Republican Party, and had many of them in my home.
Yeah, well, I ain't gonna claim I was a bigwig, but I was definitely with the bigwigs, you know.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I wasn't a bigwig in the party, but man, I had all the bigwigs in my home. I mean, I was rubbing shoulders with them, and the Presbyterian Church, I was an ordained ruling elder. I taught evangelism. And having now recognized that those things were horribly bad, this
worthless,
corrupt, counterproductive, now
net
having
minus.
Left them is a, you know, this instruction to disassociate from them. What a blessing. What a
benefit.
Yeah,
it's a net plus. Look, I see these shows. Well, I have a kind of an interest. I just like to keep my mind busy, okay?
Yeah.
And occasionally I'll be watching these shows, you know, where there's been a murder, okay? And then they solve the murder, you know, through cold case files and forensics. And oftentimes in these shows, they'll have a family member, like, say, the mother of a murdered daughter, as I saw today. And she's standing there speaking softly, smiling, with this big, ugly, pagan, ghoulish cross hanging behind her head, talking about how they'll meet again in the future. And I'm thinking, talk about a net minus in your life. You've
yeah.
lived to catch this criminal that brutalized and murdered your daughter. You know, I'm all for getting every one of them caught. That's great, but you know, this stupidity of your
yes.
worthless idiocy And I see it that way. I mean, I just
sit there. I do too. In fact, even Glenn called in on his show, and Glenn has really become a nice contributor. The guy has really come
on. Yes, he's a very bright guy.
So annoying to be a really good, excellent contributor. And he said, you know, there are two sides of the problem. One is this idea of politicians doing things that are counterproductive and against our interests, and that's bad. But he says, isn't it equally bad when religions and leaders and politicians offer false hope? And I think it's worse. I think it's actually worse. I think he's right. But the nice thing here about the covenant, getting back to it, its terms and conditions, is that every one of the conditions is a benefit for us as and is ultimately enjoyable. Walking away from politics and propaganda and patriotism and militarism and religion, all of that stuff, a huge net gain in our lives. Walking to Yahweh and enjoying the walk, which is we're going to celebrate here in less than 2 weeks. We're going to celebrate Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim. And enjoying the walk, enjoying this path that he has provided to perfect us. Pretty cool, too. And then you've got trust and rely on Yahweh. Well, the only way you can do that is spend time with him and his word to get to know him and get to know what he's offering. And there is nothing that is more fun than that. Nothing more enriching, nothing more beneficial. That's what Dode is spending all of his time doing. And then the next one is to familiarize yourself with, become aware of, value, consider the terms and conditions of the covenant, the very thing he's talking about here. But when you do that, what you find is God's dad. He's approachable. He's lovable. He wants to have fun together. And that's pretty cool.
Yeah, he grows in the relationship right along with us. But I will say this.
Yeah.
You see, before I came to understand these things, and I think this is true of everybody listening that's aware of Yahweh today, we'd see people that say they dedicated their life to some good cause. And, you know, it's like they make statues of them over it or whatever, memorialize them in some way.
Right.
But they're really forgotten about in the end. And your life, If what it is, let's say you've dedicated your life to victims' rights, in the end, you've really not done anything.
Correct.
You know, you've not changed anything. You've not done anything, and your life has been a net, worthless.
Wait.
Just worthless.
But if you have done something that causes one person who walked away from religion, who walked away from being enamored with politics, who then considered Yahweh's testimony and chose to engage in his covenant, if one person that you've encountered along life's way is in that position, then think of how much you've contributed.
You've done a lot. You've done something.
Your life has been worthwhile at that point.
And that's what we can all hope to do. I mean, the work you've done, with these books, I mean, you've actually affected thousands of us,
Well, yeah, I wasn't saying it for that purpose. What I'm trying to share, of course, is that when we do what Dode is recommending, we're creating genuine and lasting value.
Yes.
Well, Diana, I'm sorry for taking so long here before we entertained your question or comment, but please, go ahead.
That's okay. So I've been thinking about the Essenes and the Qumran scrolls.
Yes.
And are they, so what I have come across, and we'll take Judas Iscariot. So
okay.
I'm trying to get past the mindset that they were a secular humanist community. I know that's going to blow your mind, but
yeah, they weren't a secularist humanist community by any stretch of the imagination. They were an extraordinarily devoutly religious community.
But they had like a scroll 40 feet long of do's and don'ts, and you had to make a
that was the temple scroll. Yeah, the Temple Scroll is the longest scroll found at Qumran, but even it's a religious scroll. It's the dictates of what they considered to be the righteous teacher. The righteous teacher was the Essenes were the counter to the Pharisees. The Pharisees were rabbinic, and the Essenes believed that the rabbis usurped the rightful heir to the priesthood during the Maccabean period. And so the Essenes clung to this notion that their righteous teacher was deserving of the priesthood when it was usurped by rabbis. And so what you have is the same thing you have between Sunni and Shia Islam, where the division is based entirely on who was the heir to the religious authority. And that's the difference between the Essenes and the Pharisees. The group that was were secular humanists, if you will, the group that were principally political and not religious would be the Sadducees. The Sadducees were political. They were the secular humanists of their day. The Pharisees were fundamentalist religious types of rabbinic Judaism, which is the only surviving part of the only surviving religion today. All Judaism is rabbinic, Pharisaic, if you will. And the Essenes clung to a different heir for religious authority. And the Temple Scroll is from their righteous teacher, who they hold up in high esteem and view as highly authoritative in their life. I would not consider...
They're Rambam.
They're Rambam, if you will. Yeah, they're Rambam. Maimonides would be their version of Maimonides. Actually, it might even be more correct to say for the period, they're Akiba, because Akiba was a rabbinical Pharisaic Jew as opposed to the Essenes that traced their lineage through the defeated head priest. As it relates to the Essene community, I could care less about them. Their religious peculiarities mean nothing. I want to know enough, so if someone asks a question like you do, I can at least give provide an answer. But understanding their religious peculiarities, considering, half of the scrolls from that community have nothing to do with the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. They're the Essenes' own debates among themselves and their affairs. I don't care about any of that. The only thing I care about...
Using the Qumran scrolls is a basis for... And I'm not debating. I'm just doing my little journey here, too. And using the Qumran scrolls is... I just... For some reason, I just think they got corrupted somewhere. They're from the line of Aaron and
the oldest and closest... oldest manuscripts we have of the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms come from Qumran. The only other alternative is the Masoretic text, and the Masoretic text dates to the 11th century. So the Qumran scrolls are 1,400 years older. It's night and day. Then the Masoretic text takes its legacy through Babylon. It's the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms maintained by rabbis in exile in Babylon ultimately became the basis of the Masoretic text. And here you have this religious community copying the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms in Qumran. And for every book, for most books you've got 7, 8, 9, 10, 15 copies. It's not like you've only got one. And they're copied over a 350-year period of time. And they're extraordinarily similar. the differences are just minuscule between them. So, you know, if you study the scrolls, what you find is that they were meticulous, as meticulous as a human could possibly be with the tools they were working with at the time, trying to perpetuate so that there would be a lasting legacy of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms to be considered. And so that's a treasure trove of extraordinary value to us to fill in and correct the Masoretic. So, you know, your choice right now is Qumran scrolls, Dead Sea Scrolls, or the Masoretic text. Those are your only two choices. And,
yeah, and there,
between those two choices, the Qumran is... And by the way, the other thing that's interesting is if you look at, even though the Septuagint isn't a choice because there's way too many inconsistencies in it, but every major place, everyone, without exception, that the Qumran scrolls differ markedly from the Masoretic, one of Larry's favorites, where they... Yahweh said they pierced my hands and my feet, talking about crucifixion.
Yeah.
The Masoretic changed it like a lion. You know, they
mauled my feet.
Yeah. So in every place that it's a major change, the Septuagint agrees with the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Yeah, I want to say every this time. Too, Dee, just because. There are scholars that have invested, you know, their life's work, their curriculum vitae into the type of people that they were that wrote the Qumran scrolls as though we're supposed to imitate them. And as I always say, I don't care if they were cannibals. I really don't care. You know,
I don't care either.
The DSS does not hold its value to me because of how the people who wrote them lived. It holds its value to me because it's the oldest.
You know, it's kind of like when I write and translate Yahweh's testimony and I print it. I really don't care if my printer is made by Epson or Hewlett-Packard or Kodak. I don't care. It's irrelevant to me. These guys were essentially printers. That's what they did. They spent much of their time copying the scrolls. And
they weren't trying to hide Yahusha because he hadn't come yet. So had he come before they wrote theirs, maybe they too, like the Masoretes, would have tried to hide him. Who knows?
That's why it's interesting. The scroll that is the most heavily copy edited in the Masoretic text, the most different scroll from the Masoretic of all of the Dead Sea Scrolls,
Yahusha,
which is the most comprehensive presentation of Yahusha, and it is the most altered of all of the texts. It's in Yahusha, it's one word in 14 that they changed, and so it's a lot. And when you look at the...
Are you sure it's not 1 in 7? I thought it was...
No, it's 1 in 14 for the between Yahusha and... And I didn't count every single... I think I counted... I went through about a third of the book, and I counted every variance in a third of the book. I did not count, however, where the Masoretic changed Yahweh to Lord. I did not include that, and I did not include where the Masoretic vocalized the word incorrectly. But if they changed the word, changed the letters that comprise the word, or erased words or added words, I counted them, and I just mechanically went through a third of the of Yahusha and applied it to the book as a whole, and it was one word in 14 as far as that goes. And it was by far the most heavily copy edited. Like, for example, when I'm doing Daniel now, there's only been, in the seventh chapter, there's only one copy edit thus far in the whole of the seventh chapter. it's a fairly significant one, but it's only one in the whole of the seventh chapter, and it's a very awkward transition addition in the Masoretic text that is awkward, makes no sense, was a
what is
complete
it?
Fish out of water. It's in the first statement in the seventh chapter where Daniel is explaining that he has seen this vision, and he's talking about the circumstance of this vision, of this revelation. And the Masoretic text said that he wrote down a summary of it, and it's just so out of character for this guy that gives you all this detail for him to say I summarized it, and the Dead Sea Scrolls doesn't have that phrase. The Dead Sea Scrolls said I witnessed this and I wrote down what I everything I wrote down completely what I saw. And so
instead of I summarized, they gave cliff notes.
Right. Yeah, I summarized it like cliff notes. And so and for years people have known, wait a minute, that line is just so out of context with the nature of what he has written and what he's writing in this particular case, but that's what's in the Masoretic. So there's lots and lots of places like that, there's a transition in between the eighth, right in the midst, actually, of the ninth verse of the seventh chapter, when he goes from talking about the Torahless one being this very unique and loudmouthed verbose horn, and then he speaks of a vision of Yahweh, and there is just no transition between the two, none. And so you look and say, boy, do I ever? And unfortunately, you got three verses that are not extant in the Dead Sea Scrolls, and so you know that somehow they left out a transition. The Masoretic said, but I got no way to recalibrate it now. All I can tell you is that once was there, it's not there now. So that's the story of the Dead Sea Scrolls. We have Hendro also on the line. How are you this evening, or morning, or what must be approaching morning where you are?
Fairly late over there.
Yeah, good morning. It's 25 to 2 in the morning.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, I respect the fact that you're willing to spend your Shabbat with us, because it is still Shabbat for you.
Yes. It is Shabbat morning, evening type thing, yeah.
Yes. Did you have a question that you wanted to, or something you wanted to add to our program tonight?
Yeah, I'm really, really excited. I'm pumped up, as you Americans would say.
Yes.
Our first Passover, myself and Angie,
uh-huh.
is coming up. And I want to make sure that I've got this right. Rather than doing is the most important thing understanding, comprehending.
Well, I'm going to tell you what at one time I would have said, that is my impression, that's my understanding. I think I will now tell you with absolute certainty that understanding what Passover represents and celebrating that with Yahweh is the single most important thing, and there's no question whatsoever about that. It's all about your attitude, your approach, your understanding. If you recognize, and by the way, I want to be really clear about this too.
Yeah.
It's not just Passover. It is Passover, unyeasted bread, and Bukkurim. Yeah. And while that's over 3 days and actually a celebration that lasts 7 days, they are a unified whole. And we ought to celebrate them as a unified whole. These are three steps that we take in three days that we celebrate our relationship with Yahweh, but they are inseparable and they are forever linked. And the benefit of them, the beauty of them, the result of them is all achieved when we look at them collectively. And what Passover is about is us going from being mortal to immortal. We, like light, transformed into light. Become immortal as a result of Passover. It's what happened on the first Passover with the Passover lamb on the doorway to life. The blood of that Passover lamb was a sign on the doorway to life. And we become immortal by celebrating Pesach Passover with Yahweh. We then become perfect when we celebrate matzah, which is the it's an even more important celebration as matzah on yeasted bread, where the fungus of yeast is removed from our sin. And Yosha explains that the yeast represents political and religious corruption. And so when we walk away from those things, Yahweh is in a position where he can remove all of our faults, all of our flaws, and we appear perfect in his eyes. And that's the great celebration, that he himself, with his soul, ransomed us by paying the price to free us from the penalty associated with our corruption, which would be separation from him. So we gain direct access to God and appear perfect in his eyes because of the celebration of matzah and what he did for us on this day. And collectively, that enables us to be children born into the first family. We become like light, perfect, energetic, empowered, enriched. We become, you and Angie become Yahweh's son and daughter, inheriting all that he has to give, including becoming like him and being transformed into light. All of that is the result of these 3 days. And when we celebrate that as a participant in the covenant, we receive all the benefit. So if you have correctly ascertained that this party is about understanding, but it's also a celebration of that understanding. I mean, this is pretty cool stuff. It's worth getting pumped up over, use the American idiom. Really pretty amazing stuff. The very God that created the universe and life and offered us the covenant wants to give us these three gifts and wants us to celebrate the receipt of these gifts with him.
Yeah. It's amazing. It's mind-blowing.
It's amazing.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And you know what's so wonderful about it? If you could envision a perfect God and he was exactly as you would want him to be, wouldn't this be what you would envision?
I would have thought it wasn't possible.
Yeah, it's true. It's almost too good to be real, isn't it?
Yeah, there's no such thing as a free lunch. So, you know, I have to give. It's going to cost me my arm or my leg or my life.
Yeah, he just asked us to party with him. That's all he does. Yeah. I mean,
but you know, it does cost us something. Yeah, to celebrate this, to benefit from it, you absolutely have to be willing to invest some of your time, some of your emotional energy, some of your mental energy. You have to be willing to prioritize your relationship with him. It does cost you something. Now, it's interesting. That cost is pretty de minimis compared to the benefit. And in fact, the argument could be made that it's not cost at all.
I almost feel guilty for the fact of what you've actually told me it costs. And it still sounds to me like it's free.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, you know, as I look at it, Andrew, rather than me contributing something to it and it costing me something, I almost feel guilty in a way too that the things that Yahweh has asked of us, the terms and conditions of the covenant, and the meeting with Him on these days to celebrate this.
Yeah.
Since those things are so beneficial, so enjoyable, it looks like the cost that I'm paying is having to accept the most valuable presence in the world, okay? So I've got to hold the basket that's holding the most valuable presence in the world. Boy, that's a heck of a burden.
Yeah. And if you let go of it, it floats away.
Yeah, and you know what, the most amazing part is not what he is giving you in terms of giving us. You know, okay, getting eternal life, that's a really nice gift. Being made perfect and being made empowered like light, that's a really nice gift. Being adopted and inheriting all that God has to give, that's a really nice gift. Okay, I get that. Those are nice gifts. That's not the most magnificent part of this. The most magnificent part of this is we get to spend eternity being exploring the universe with Yahweh. I mean, that's the real gift in all of this. That's the most amazing thing, is what those three gifts enable, which is we get to spend all eternity camping out with the coolest dude that there ever was.
It's mind-blowing.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm trying to imagine what you guys felt like your first Passover, you know, because you can only do it once, I'm assuming, you know. You can only...
Well,
come
that's,
out and
you know, I celebrated it with as much
once.
As... Yeah, I celebrate it with greater enthusiasm each time, and I look forward to it more each time. Because
I agree with that.
Time,
I agree
yeah,
with
each
that.
Time I'm parting with the Father that I've come to know and love, and the better I know Him, the more that I've come to love Him, the more I've come to appreciate what He's offering, the more I come to enjoy it. I can't wait for the 7-day celebration because
I will tell you the first time I felt quite lost. I mean, not. You know, hopelessly lost, but really felt like I'm not doing anything. You know, I felt inadequate.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And then when I found it that if I study what Yahweh shared about these dates, if I celebrate what He had to say about these dates, if I think about it and converse with Him about these things, that then I am in fact doing it. That is what doing it is all about. You know, the single most important thing of all of it is what happened with Abram, which is why I shared that story when at the beginning of the program, where it's so revealing that Yahweh viewed Abraham as vindicated, as righteous, as perfect, as innocent, the moment he came to understand. And so that's why I can tell you with absolute certainty that understanding and appreciating, you know, accepting, trusting, and relying on this, that's it. Man, that's the beauty of it. Now, you get to go to a party with the creator of the universe. Now, that's as they say in the South,
parties.
That's pretty tall cotton.
Yeah, and a party of parties.
It's a party of parties.
It's just making me grin so much.
Yeah.
You know, just think about it.
Yeah. Yeah. The more we come to know who Yahweh is, what He is offering, how we participate, the more wonderful it is. And it just stuns me. It's why I think why we are all so disappointed, frustrated by religion is that they take this marvelous Father and this just stunningly beneficial covenant and these wonderful parties and this the ultimate opportunity that exists in the universe, and they reject all of it for just stupefying deception, corruption, and perversion. And you want to scream and say, you know, it's not just that what you're offering is stupid and unreliable and moronic. It's look what you've taken people away from.
Yeah. I don't understand that. I can't understand that. I mean, I respect you guys so much because I know, because I've done it, and I know people, I've seen people lots that are doing it, you know, these TV evangelists, whatever. You could have whatever you wanted if you were just, you know, for want of a better word, if you were tempted, if you were just to bow the knee, you can have whatever you wanted. You've got the skills, you've got the intelligence, you've got the wisdom, you know, and for the fact that you will not bow the knee, you will not turn that way, I just respect you guys so much.
Oh, I want to make this really clear. I'm tempted in lots of ways, and I'm flawed, so was Dode. So, you know, that's why I love Dode so much. He's my favorite dude in all of the story because, you know, I'm a lot like him. I'm not as smart as he is, but you know, I'm like him. I'm a flawed dude. I can tell you for absolute certain that I have never even remotely been tempted to say, boy, you know, if I were to use some of these skill sets, I could really get a large following, make a lot of money, and have a really swell time. Never even crossed my mind. It seems laughable to me that anyone in the right. Why would you trade working with God, sharing moments like this with your Heavenly Father, getting not only to learn what He is offering and spending this quality time with Him, but also being able to share it with fellow family members and have the thrill of knowing that what you're doing is in some small way increasing the size of Yahweh's family and making Him happy? You'd think that you'd trade that for some momentary pretense of an earthly gain? I mean, not even in a billion years. I mean, I've told you that in this program, and maybe you've listened only long after I've said this, so I'm going to share it again. Mm-hmm. Everything I do here, I do. I gain far more from it than I give. So you know, when someone wants to say thank you, I just say, "Come on, that's silly." I mean, when we're all learning together, we're all growing together, and what we gain individually is vastly more than what we contribute to it. But there is one aspect of all of this that I've always looked forward to, and it's a personal thing, and maybe it could be the only thing that could be considered selfish, but there's one thing that I'm looking forward to. I want to be there when you walk in front of Yahweh for the first time, when Larry walks in front of Yahweh for the first time, when James walks in front of Yahweh for the first time, when his wife Patty walks in front of Yahweh for the first time, and I want to see the expression on God's face when He greets you and hugs you for the first time. I want to be in the room when that happens. I don't want any acknowledgement. I just want to be in the back of the room and see the smile. That for me is the I guess it's a little bit selfish, but it's the satisfaction that I do want, is I want to share that moment of warmth, of embrace, of love, of just utter satisfaction. I want to see it.
Hmm. That's a beautiful picture.
It is a beautiful picture. And it's probably the most selfish thing that I think, because it's personal. This is a personal thing between you and Yahweh for the first time you meet, and somewhere in the back of the room, I'd like to be there. You know, I don't care if I'm 500 feet away, but I want to be able to see the expression on our Heavenly Father's face when He hugs you right there in person for the first time. And I know that He's light energy. I know we're going to be light energy. And I know that, you know, that the whole concept of expressions will be different. But God, you know, describes the warmth of His energy when He is in heaven. I want to see it. I think it's why the universe was created, for those moments.
Oh, sharing those moments in relationships.
Yes.
And of course.
Yeah.
That's great. I mean, according to Yahweh, it is relationship, which goes back to, you know, I don't think most people honestly believe in that there is a God, and most people don't believe Yahweh's words.
Right.
If they did, they would understand why we were put here. We weren't put here to effect change in legislative bodies.
No.
We were put here for the purposes of relationship.
Right.
You know, and that's our purpose.
And we have our opportunity here on life to share that covenant relationship with others. It's the single most important thing we can do, is to share what the Yahweh we have come to know and the covenant that He has offered with all who are open to Him. And that is the single most important, valuable, beneficial way, and most fun way, by the way, we can spend our lives. And selfishly, I'm going to tell you that, I don't think there's anything wrong with this kind of selfishness either. I can't wait to the first journey of exploration that we get to go on with Yahweh, and everybody that is with us this evening. And collectively, we get to go and explore. I want to go explore planets that are part of different solar systems in different galaxies and witness all of the life that is flourishing there. And I want to make this transition, just as he did, from light to matter, so that we can be caught for a moment in the ordinary flow of time in this place, just celebrating life and understanding all of its aspects with the architect of life. I just think that collectively, and I want to, at the end of that first day of discovery, where we're actually stuck in time because we take on material form for a moment, I want to have the biggest bonfire you can imagine, and I want to be cooking some really good, perfect meat on that bonfire and having a great glass of wine and breaking bread and telling stories and singing songs and celebrating the day that we had and laughing together. That's what I expect eternity to be like, and I can't wait to get there.
That's an amazing picture.
Yeah, I want to do that stuff. That's the stuff that God is offering us. I want to do that. I just, can you imagine being able to do it without any of the limitations we have now?
Well, I mean, you're talking about unimaginable. Honestly,
right.
I can't imagine it.
Yeah.
I can't imagine it.
Yeah, but I like to. We have Tiffany also, who has held here for a while, and I know Tiffany, you might have a question or a comment, and the moments we have left, please let's hear from you.
Hi, great. Sorry, I just wanted to call in based on a conversation that I had heard on Saturn Myths earlier in the week about a young man who called regarding the church and how they were kind of celebrating Passover, or they were celebrating the feast a little bit.
Yeah, every other year they celebrate Passover in a rabbinic format, and then they go to Easter, and then they go back and forth.
Right.
Well, they mix two religions into a place that should have none. But,
yeah.
Okay.
Right.
Okay, go ahead, Tiffany.
Right. Well, so the question that I have is that, and more of it maybe, I guess, is a concern. 8 years ago, when I started to read what you were writing, and
mm-hmm.
I went straight to Exodus, and it said, you shall celebrate this for the rest of your life. And every day, and it never ceases. And it was 7 days before Passover,
mm-hmm.
and I called everybody I knew, and I celebrated Passover, because
mm-hmm.
it says we're supposed to.
Right.
And then the next year, you know, I'd shared with my family a little bit,
uh-huh.
and the next year my family attended.
Uh-huh.
You know, they came and they attended, and I was concerned based on the conversation this week because I've actually never asked my dad if he's circumcised. I didn't ask any of the men who attended, are they circumcised?
Right.
I just wanted to celebrate Passover, and I wanted all of my friends to do it with me. And they did. So I guess my question is, did I essentially destine my family?
That's an interesting question.
Or can
I think the likelihood of that is remote in the extreme. And the reason for this is that if your father and the others that you invited to, and
mm-hmm.
we're going to, by the way, continue to record even though it's not going to broadcast. So the broadcast is over. Thank you all for listening and for participating. We're going to go ahead and address Tiffany's concern. It'll be part of the archives for those that want to hear it. I don't think it is, well, I have made the example that the worst possible thing would be to properly observe Passover and not observe matzah, which is what Satan intends through the Christian focus on the crucifixion, but total ignorance of matzah, that's the worst of all possible circumstances because it would cause a person to be just like Satan, eternal, but eternally separated from Yahweh. It is, based upon what we've all come to know, essentially impossible for a person to properly celebrate Passover, which means, as Hendro said, to understand what Passover represents as part of Pesach, Matzah, and Bekorim, because they're a unified whole. If you understand what Passover, Matzah, and Bekorim represent as a unified whole, then there is no way in the world that you're going to stop at Passover. But if you're willing to stop at Passover and celebrate it, but you're not willing to celebrate Matzah, then it says that you don't understand what Passover represents. You don't understand its role in the seven steps that we take to be in a position to camp out with God. So what I'm trying to say is that there is no chance whatsoever that those you invited could have celebrated Pesach in such a way that Yah would say, yes, you are now immortal, if they didn't also understand the importance of becoming perfected on Matzah and being adopted on Bukurim. So I don't think you have anything to worry about. As a matter of fact,
they also couldn't have understood the role that Yahusha played. I mean, really.
Right.
I mean, he's
there's more to
days.
Understanding and observing than just actually
right.
having the meal.
Correct.
Well, it's just like you see people do Shabbat, and Shabbat isn't about how little you do. It's about an understanding, you know, that this is the promise of the seventh day of rest.
Right.
Yah was still in day six, his time.
Right.
He's about to step into day seven in a matter of seconds from his perspective. From our
so when I'm sure that's explanation perspective, Tiffany, I should probably do a better job of saying that from Satan's perspective, where he understands exactly what Passover is all about and how it transitions into Matzah and how those two are inseparable and essential and how they lead to our being invited into God's home as his children on Bukurim, while the adversary understands all of that, and he would love it for the religion that he conceived to focus only on Passover and not get beyond it because it would make everyone just like him. The reality is there has never been a Christian ever that has embraced Passover, celebrated, understanding what it represents, and Yahweh's role in it, and the fate of the purpose of the Passover lamb, and how his soul then went that evening and went into Matzah, went into Sheol on Matzah, and what Yosha said about what Matzah, what yeast represents in terms of religious and political corruption, and how that leads to an entirely new individual, an individual that's been transformed so that you're no longer even recognizable as Yosha was at that point. If you understand all of that and therefore could capitalize on all of that, then you're part of the covenant family. And there's no harm done, there's only benefit. And if you don't understand all that, then you haven't really participated in it. You've gone through the motions. It would be like a Orthodox Jew celebrating Passover in a religious way and reading religious prayers and saying that all this represents is the Hashem's taking us out of Egypt and never going further than that. They're not benefiting from Passover. They're not becoming immortal. They're wasting their time. In fact, William sent me a link about a Passover ball that is being promoted where, I think it was someplace in Florida, that you sign up and drinks around the pool and a celebration with other Jews as they offer a kosher meal on Passover while you're drinking and partying as singles to meet other Jewish singles. They're just going through the motions. It's no merit to it.
That's actually a really good point. You know, if just celebrating it, you know, performing the holiday was what got you the benefit of it, then
right.
every Jew would be saved, regardless of understanding or knowing Yah.
Correct. And when Yah says, you know, I don't know you, get away from me, or when Yah says, I'm divorcing myself of you because you're married to Lord Baal, that would not make sense unless going through the motions was meaningless.
Exactly.
So if I was trying to reach out to my family,
uh-huh.
Because when I discovered all of this, I lived thousands of miles away from my family. And it was easy because I could celebrate it and they didn't have to know and I didn't have to cause any heartburn or dissension among family members. If now that I'm local and they're close by, it's probably best to invite them something to a Pentecost dinner over a Passover dinner. Right?
Well, yeah, it's not Pentecost, it's Shavuot, the celebration of the promise of the Shabbat. You are correct that everyone is Yahweh explicitly asked us to invite everyone, including those who are part of the covenant and those who are estranged from him, to Shavuot. So you are absolutely correct that that is the best place of all to invite them. And that to invite them to celebrate Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim with you once they understand the terms and conditions of the covenant. And I think I would really emphasize, too, that there's only one covenant. There are five terms and conditions of the covenant, and there are five benefits of the covenant, and that we receive all five benefits of the covenant when we celebrate these first four Moed Mikre, these invitations to meet with God. You know, the five benefits of the covenant are eternal life, perfection, adoption, enrichment, and empowerment. And those are the express purpose of the first four Moed Mikre. It's why Yahusha, in the fourth millennia of human history from being expelled from the garden, fulfilled the first four Mikre. And he stopped there, because the first four Mikre enable all the promises of the covenant. And so if they can equate, when they get to the point, because you've invited them to Shavuot, and they get to the point, they understand this seven-step path and how it relates to the conditions of the covenant and the benefits of the covenant and the Torah's role in presenting the covenant. When you've been able to explain that and they say, I get it, I accept it, then by all means invite them to participate in Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim.
Okay. And so then one just other really small question.
Okay.
Maybe. If they become interested,
mm-hmm.
and they say, I get it, but they just don't necessarily have the time to invest in the research.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But they just kind of get it.
Right.
Which was how it worked for me. It was like it was like someone took the blinders off and I got it. I didn't have a lot of time to research, but I just got it.
Yeah.
That doesn't, their lack of research or their lack of following down that path doesn't negate the promise, right?
Like no, it doesn't. In fact, I would say that most people I know who have come to get it, where they had that Abraham moment of, oh, I get it, now I understand, and it just all of a sudden, it all makes sense, all falls into place, I get it. Most people who have come to that have heard the testimony, had it summarized for them, and got enough of the details to say, oh, yeah, of course, this makes perfect sense, I get it. I'm with you in saying that you are part of the majority. I am unique in that it was a struggle for me. I don't mean struggle in a negative sense. I really had to wrestle with it. And maybe it's because I was so poisoned by the Christian religion. Maybe because I was so political. Maybe it's because I'm so just stupidly resolutely rational, where unless all the pieces fit together and I could make all the connections, that, you know, I wasn't willing to go there. So, you know, for me, it took a while. I might have just been a slow learner. my experience is that most people are like you. My closest friend, Yoel, we spent a lot of time, because his issue was he was an agnostic, and he was an agnostic because religious claims were just flat out stupid, and he was way too smart to buy into a religious God. And so in our discussions, and we were close because of business, and we would spend time after business into 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, with me systematically showing how the God of the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms wasn't responsible for the stupid claims of religion. And once I did that and said, so he could recognize that Yahweh was not religious and she should not be judged based upon the stupidity of religion, then it was a matter of maybe 2 hours worth of presenting, this is who he is and what he's offering. And Yoel just says, oh, now I get it. And he could go on for 20 hours without reading anything more and said, I just get it. I mean, he could tell me, he says, of course, that's how it has to be. No, I couldn't come up with anything that surprised him from that point, no matter what I had learned. He said, of course, that's the way it has to be. He just got it. Switch went on. Light went on. And I think that
I was
quite common.
To get out of the church.
Yeah.
I had been hurt so bad I didn't even know. I mean, you talk about beaten and bloody, and that was me when I walked out. And I was
a horrible place
because I knew that the God I loved wasn't
there.
In the church.
Yeah,
he just wasn't
true.
There. I was like, there's just no way that this can be the case. And so,
yeah.
You know, don't get me wrong. I tried for a long time, for probably 2 years, to prove you wrong.
Okay.
I did.
I'm glad.
Didn't do very good, obviously.
I'm glad. By the way, you're not, well, that would be your perspective initially. You're trying to prove me wrong. After you've spent the 2 years trying to prove me wrong, what you're going to find is that you weren't debating against me at all. What you found is that all I was trying to share with you is what Yahweh tells us, and you can't prove God wrong. And so after a while, and I'm really glad you did that. I mean, wrestling through that is the right thing to do. Don't trust any individual, but after a while you find it, okay, God, you know, you really got your act together. Everything you say makes sense. It's everything you say is exactly as you'd want it to be. It's this great, wonderful celebration of everything as it should be.
Right.
You know, if you want the most impossible job in the world, try to find where God has made a mistake.
Yeah, I think I can. I think I'll enjoy other things.
Yeah, me too. So I'm glad you came that way. I'm glad you did your due diligence to make certain that you recognize that you can't prove God wrong. You might as well just the smartest thing you can do is embrace and accept and celebrate who he is and what he's offering.
Right. And I just, you know, I'm excited about it. I'm always excited about it. I appreciate your time. And I'm enjoying my Friday evenings off.
Oh, good. Good.
Getting back.
Me
I'm
too.
Getting back into it. It's been a while since I've been around, but
good.
I'm just glad to be back and appreciate everything that you do.
And if you ever have the opportunity, please call into the Shattering Myths Show, because your testimony, your experience would be valuable, appreciated.
Well, I talked to you on Monday. I was
kind of
the tail end on Monday.
Yeah,
I'm
that's right. You did. Yes, you did.
But
and,
I
do it again, please.
Okay.
It wasn't so terrifying, was it?
No. I was terrified while I was on hold, and then I was like, you know what? I just really want to know the answer.
Yeah.
I really want to know if it's okay to want to have kids in this.
Yeah.
Very dicey time in history.
Oh yeah, I love that call. That was
my wife struggles with that.
Yeah, I know. That's why
she
I mentioned you.
Worried.
Yeah, I mentioned you and Patty and this and Yahweh and Yirmiyah gave us the perfect answer. He gave us the answer that says you do not need to worry. That, you know, first of all, being a mom, and for me, I'm, you know, male, so being a dad is the single most enriching, fulfilling, beneficial thing that I can do in this life. Being a mom is the single most fulfilling, enriching thing you can do in this life. And it helps you appreciate and know Yahweh better. We have a closer relationship with him. And so God wants us to be parents. Absolutely wants us to be parents. And he knows that we know the timing. And so he, in his open letter to us Goyim, said, let me tell you about the children of covenant parents. They're part of the covenant. And so he removed all of your concern. You are in the perfect, right now, you and Patty and James are in the perfect situation, because your child is absolute guaranteed admission into Yahweh's family. and you get to enjoy your child in the process. You couldn't be in a better position.
Okay, so along those lines of getting to enjoy being a parent, enjoying having children,
right,
on and so forth, minus the, you know, lack of sleep and being scared to death, you know, because you're now raising an infant.
Yeah,
and then,
it's,
you
true,
know,
it's true. But that's part of it, though. That's part of the joy, is that if raising a child and having a family didn't require effort on our part, then it wouldn't be nearly as enriching. In all relationships, you have to make a contribution to the relationship to get something out of it. So, yeah, you're going to make an investment, and you're going to have some sleepless nights, and yet you're going to look in your child's eyes, and when you're with them, and say, "Oh my, isn't this wonderful?" Even when you're groggy.
Right, but okay. So here's kind of the follow-on question.
Okay.
So they're young, right? And
okay,
you do everything you can to keep them safe.
Right.
Right. You know who you let in your home, or you know
right,
which daycare center you leave them
right,
with, or you're with them
yeah,
all the time.
Yeah. Well, by the way, that's just to a certain extent. You can't, you have to allow every child to live their life, to explore, to take risks. If you don't allow your child to take risks and to explore, then you're shortchanging them. So we can't protect them from everything that is potentially harmful.
Correct. But we've
okay,
got all of these possible
right,
Muslim jihadists who
right,
are going to go
right,
rampaging
right,
through our country and or
right,
rampaging through our
right,
they go through
right,
our schools, they go through
right,
everything.
Right.
So,
of course.
So how do you, I guess that's the question. It's like, I want to have kids. Okay.
Okay.
Yah says it's okay to have kids. He'll
okay,
protect me. He'll
oh,
protect
right,
them.
Right, right. 2015 is the earliest you could give birth at this point would be 2015.
Correct.
And 2015 is just 11 years before the harvest.
Right, but are they really, what happens when they're in school and I can't protect them, or they
so,
wander
so
off
just say
and
that,
I can't protect
let's say
them,
that you have a precious little daughter, and your precious little daughter 11 years from now, or 10 years from now, or 9 years from now, is at school, and somebody does something really stupid and takes their life,
yeah,
then they're just going to precede you to heaven. They'll precede you to heaven.
Because I am
the likelihood
of
that happening is not particularly great. But if that happens, you know, God's not going to intervene to keep the Muslim from doing something stupid. And so if somebody does something stupid and your daughter's life is shortchanged, then they will get a head start with you in heaven, and a year or two later, you'll meet up with them again.
Okay, so it's really just that I mean, they're not going to get shortchanged if something were to happen or anything
they
like
might
that.
Be, well, they're going to be shortchanged
like
in terms of an earthly life. I don't know if that's really shortchanged. I mean, I happen to enjoy my earthly life. I think it's wonderful. I can't wait for the eternal experience, but I happen to I'm having a grand time. And they are going to be shortchanged in terms of this experience. Absolutely. But is it worth it for them to have the opportunity for eternity? Absolutely.
Okay.
You can conceive a child
yeah,
who's guaranteed to spend eternity with the Yahweh in heaven, and that's worth doing.
Okay. That's all I wanted
doing,
to know.
Yeah, that's worth doing.
That's all my questions for like the last 2 weeks.
Okay. Well,
and
call in with more. I loved your question on the show. Thank you.
I'm sure I'll come up with more. I've been really – I listen to you while I'm reading contracts because that's what I do
okay,
for a living.
Okay.
Yeah, fun.
Yeah, but you know, there's benefit in that. There's benefit in reading those contracts, knowing what contracts
there
they
is,
mean. The contract law is very similar to the covenant.
It is, and I think that's why I get it.
Yeah.
I think that's why I enjoy it.
Sure.
You know, I feel like I'm living in both.
Yeah,
and
I think a lot of us were predisposed to get it. Being in contract law, you're predisposed to get it. Yeah, it's you have
yeah,
an advantage.
It's in our nature.
Yeah, it's in your nature. It was in James's nature. He was a questioning agnostic that was open-minded and genuinely wanted to know. It was in your nature.
Well, the only thing I wanted to know when I got started was how the dinosaurs fit in.
Oh, yeah.
That's the only, that's the only question in the
very
beginning.
Wasn't that funny that, that Yawa actually spoke of creating dinosaurs? He used the term mighty reptile.
Used the exact word.
Yeah. What, but mighty reptile is the Greek word that becomes dinosaur. It's based upon mighty reptile. And so he talks about creating the mighty reptiles, dinosaurs. And I also like the fact that he used the term Big Bang. I think it's
Big
hilarious.
Bang.
I mean, he's got a sense of humor.
Oh, yeah. I love his sense of humor.
So
I'm sure I'll come up with more to ask you.
Okay. Please. Let's do it.
Follow up with questions on during the work week. So, thank you so much for your time and have a wonderful Passover.
Shabbat. We'll be together before we start celebrating Passover one more time.
Yes.
All right. Thank you, guys.
Perfect. Thank you.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Good night. Happy Shabbat.
Have a good night.
Bye-bye.
Bye.